Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time.
Welcome to the AAMFT podcast. Today, I'm bringing you a one-of-a-kind, very special roundtable with six remarkable early career MFTs, each of whom have graduated within the last 2 years, and they're navigating this exciting, challenging journey from student to professional. So if you're an MFT in training, a recent graduate, or just curious about what it's really like to launch a career in systemic therapy, you're in the right place today. Our panelists share candid stories about what drew them to the field, the pivotal moments that shaped their paths, and the unique challenges they faced as they step into their role as therapist. You'll hear about the transition from the supportive environment of graduate school to the realities of building a caseload, finding supervision, and balancing self-care with the demands of our profession. We'll talk about imposter syndrome, the importance of community, and practical hurdles like paperwork, the national licensure exam, and managing finances. These are things that every new therapist encounters. But most importantly, you'll hear voices of resilience, compassion, and hope. Our guests open up about the power of self-compassion, the value of staying connected to their peers and community, and the small acts of self-care that make a big difference. So whether you're just starting out or supporting someone who it is, or thinking about a career in systemic therapy, MFT, this conversation is packed with wisdom, encouragement, and real-world advice. So let's settle in and join us as we explore the journey, challenges, and triumphs of early career MFTs.
As therapists, you know how common it is for couples or families where alcohol misuse has damaged trust. Even when progress is made in session, that trust can crumble the moment doubt creeps back in at home. SoberLink changes that with discreet, real-time alcohol monitoring, complete with built-in facial recognition and tamper detection. Families get the proof they need to rebuild confidence and move forward. And now, with affordable device rental options, you can introduce SoberLink to clients without the financial barrier. Support lasting change by requesting free client resources delivered straight to your inbox at www.soberlink.com/marriage-counselors. That's www.soberlink.com/marriage-counselors. I'm so happy to be joined by a panel of six early career MFTs. They've all graduated within the last 2 years, and they're going to share with us their experience today. They're all special to me for a number of reasons, because they were my students and now they were my colleagues. So we're just going to start a quick introduction. tell everybody your name and your kind of MFT origin story, why you wanted to become a systemic individual couple and family therapist.
Okay, so my name is Allie Montgomery. I think my MFT origin story is I've always been interested in like couples dynamics, but didn't really know how I would make that into a career. So I put that interest on the back burner. And then I was working with kids with autism as a registered behavior therapist, going in home, working with, it was early intervention. So anywhere from age 2 to about 9. So getting that experience in the home, the kiddos made a lot of progress, but I saw that they weren't super able to maintain their gains unless the family was bought into treatment as well. So that was my first introduction to, I guess, systemic thinking and how things were so interwoven. I was also exposed to a lot of like parents oversharing about things that had nothing to do with the kids, their marriages or their friends or different challenges. So that really opened my eyes and gave me more of a clear-cut path about family therapy and what that would look like. And that's what gave me a taste and caused me to look into how I could put that into practice. And then I found the program and found you, Dr. Eli, and the rest is history.
Hi, Will. Next, my name is Jennifer Coulter. And for me, I think mine started way back when I was a kid. I'm from a fairly big family of 6 people in my family total. And I was always the peacemaker in my family. So I was the one who was like trying to have family meetings all the time and like keeping the family. We can't fight, guys. We got him pulling a family meeting. And so I think from those early stages, I didn't really understand that was where I was going to end up landing now. But I remember that I wanted to be a therapist since I was 16, but I didn't necessarily know what type of therapist. And so when I was researching programs, I remember seeing a quote that said, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And then I looked into that and I saw that I was a couple and family therapist. And it all just came together for me there. But I truly believe that the whole is greater than the sum. And so that, to me, with my past as being that peacemaker role, was a no-brainer for me to become a systemic therapist.
I'll go. I also, like Jennifer was saying, was always a peacemaker in my family and still to this day feel that tendency and that desire to like jump in and like smooth things out for people. And I even noticed I did that in the program with my cohort mates. But yeah, separation, like my family separating or relationships dissolving was always like the biggest fear for me. I think really it took, I was previously married and divorced, and then my parents got divorced very shortly after I got divorced. And that kind of was a really big deal for me and a really huge opportunity for growth, honestly, and really led me to seeing all the things in my past, like all the little MFT like seeds that have been sprinkled throughout my life that I didn't necessarily take root at the moment, but took quite a while to like for me to realize that is the pathway I wanted to go. So yeah, my growing up in my family and then also just relationships and connection have always been like the foundation of my life. So thinking of things in terms of systems and relationships and things like that really just made sense to me in ways that other pathways to being a therapist didn't. Oh, that's why I'm here in a nutshell.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Right. And I think I'll piggyback off of that, given my connection to Hillary. My name is Jeffrey Helton. I'm actually married to Hillary, the previous speaker. I guess for me, I think it's probably a pretty common story, but I was around the age of 16 and I decided I would really like to be a therapist. I was taking AP psychology at that point in time. And something about it just made all the light bulbs in my head go off. It seemed an area of study where you're penetrating a little deeper than people normally go, and that really just activated all these intellectual parts of me and my curiosity. I had the vision at that point, but I did not necessarily have the gumption. I was pretty intimidated by the path. I didn't know what all the different paths could be to being a therapist, and think that I kind of just took my time, meandered a little bit through life, but again, I just kept feeling this tug that this is the kind of work that I want to do. And as I went through life, I was already thinking in those systemic terms and thinking that basically every problem that I've ever encountered, that's a real complex problem, feels like a Rubik's Cube where all these pieces are connected and you can't change one part without changing the dynamic of everything. And so once I realized that there was a field of therapy that's basically built on that premise, it really felt like that was the right fit. And Hillary and I, at that point, we were both just dating, but we had been on the same page in terms of, hey, this seems like a direction that we can grow together. So it just made sense that we take the leap and have a built-in study buddy and accountability partner and get things done.
I can go next. My name's Maddie. And I relate to a lot of what people are saying too. I've always got a lot of fulfillment, I think, from just being with people, being around people. And so I always wanted to be a therapist, but to be honest, I was very unsure if I could manage it. I wasn't sure if I had the emotional resilience or bandwidth to do the work. So I just explored a lot of other jobs in the psychology realm. I tried nonprofit work for a little bit. I tried also, similar to what Allie was talking about, I tried working with kiddos with autism, and just through trial and error, kept realizing things that weren't fitting for me and just kept revisiting that idea of being a therapist. And I really enjoyed too in college playing a peer advisor role. I worked with a lot of students incoming who were dealing, now looking back, with a lot of pressures socially and from their family and adjusting to this like major life transition and what they needed to do. And I enjoyed helping them work through that. And so I think around the time COVID hit, that was like my push for me to just try it and see if I could manage it. And I think the program came recommended to me. And I really enjoyed the social components of it too, like the emphasis of like diversity and equity and inclusion and all of those pieces. And I don't think it was actually until I was like in the program, really in the depths of it, that I realized that the systemic way of looking at things really fit like my own belief system.
Okay, I can bring us home. I'm Frankie Jones. I use he and they pronouns. And so before I started down the path towards becoming an MFT, I was working in like progressive political work and social change work and community organizing, and like taking that route to trying to make the world a safer place for people to live in, and especially for marginalized people to live in, and kept bumping up against challenges in that work that really felt like they were about relationships and our ability to work through conflict with each other and like to actually build a world where we're able to be less isolated and be in powerful relationships and take care of one another. And at the same time, I was going through a pretty major rupture in my family of origin, and my family was having a lot of difficulty working through conflict. And we ended up going to family therapy, and it was really helpful and continues to be really helpful. And I found myself like really looking for this set of tools for like how to support us to build sustainable relationships at the family level, at the community level, at the interpersonal level, and was also listening to a lot of Esther Perel's podcast at the time, which I just didn't really know that being a couples therapist was a real option. And I loved listening to that podcast and found myself, it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, I could really imagine myself doing that. I can see myself in that work. And it really connects to how I show up in group and community spaces as like a mediator and as somebody who is always trying to help people make connections and like work through things. And yeah, so it just felt like a really natural fit. And being somebody who sees the world through a really systemic lens at the micro level and the macro level, this program just felt like a perfect fit for me. And yeah, I'm loving it.
Yeah. Thank you, Frankie. So if you're listening to this, you probably have, or you're attending or have graduated from a co-AMFT program. That's an accredited program. There's many benefits and there are some commonalities, but then there's always some very specific things about each program. So everybody on the panel today has graduated from a program at the University of Louisville's Kent School of Social Work and Family Science. We are the Family Science Wing, and it is a social justice oriented program, and it's one of the only MFT program housed within a school of social work. It's so wonderful hearing these stories. I know you all very well, but still, like many people, even though those are six different stories, there are common threads. And even if you didn't have systemic language, you always thought that way. And then you found MFT. Everybody here had some work experience in a diverse MFT cohort. You'll see people fresh out of undergrad to people in their second or maybe third career into their 30s or 40s. Did you all know of MFT, or was it through your search? I didn't know till I stumbled upon it, but not till almost the end of my undergraduate career. I had no idea that there was a standalone profession known as marriage and family therapy. How did you first find out about MFT?
For me, I think I first found out about it in 2013. I was going through my own mental health crisis at the time, and I ended up seeing an MFT. I wasn't actively seeking out any particular kind of credentials. I just happened into that relationship. And it wasn't too impactful or too meaningful, but then my next therapist was also an MFT. And so at that point, the seed had been planted. And it's like whenever you start noticing everybody's driving a Toyota, I'm like starting to see the terminology everywhere that I look. So that definitely planted a critical seed for me at that.
That's how it was for me. I think it's so funny how our stories overlap in a lot of ways, because I was actually in therapy myself and my therapist was an MFT. And I remember I was trying to find a program, and there wasn't a program that I could just go on the website and see in Louisville. So I was like, I'm going to have to go to Northern or I'm going to go to Western or something to accomplish this. And then it was almost like the MFT gods like sprinkled this program, and it just appeared out of nowhere. And it was right around the time when I had seen that quote about the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And so then that kind of percolated my curiosity. So I asked my therapist about it, and then the rest is history.
I think my knowledge of MFT happened after I had graduated with my undergrad degree. I was working as a lab manager for a cognitive psychology lab at Michigan State University, which is where I graduated with my undergrad. And I had decided grad school wasn't for me. I was like tired. I didn't want to be in school anymore, just to be real. And was scared of the cost, but still was curious about being a therapist. And the only pathways I really knew, for whatever reason, were like, you can get a degree in social work, or you can be like, get your PhD and be like a psychologist. Those were like the two things that I knew at that time. And I decided to go to the therapy clinic on campus and interview, like just talk with one of the therapists who worked there. She was an LMFT. That was the first time I ever heard of marriage and family therapy. And so to me, that earlier when I said like these little seeds had been sprinkled, that was really the first one. And I didn't really pursue it then. I think I had a lot of fear that held me back. But yeah, then throughout life, it just kept being sprinkled to the point when I actually decided to look into it and see what it was. But yeah, had no clue it existed. It took me like over a decade to make the decision to pursue it.
Yeah, this is Allie speaking. And similar to Hillary, I knew about social work. I knew about becoming a psychologist, and neither one of those really felt like it was the path that I felt was for me. And I actually think I was watching some reality TV show, and there was someone who was like a couples expert. And I remember looking them up thinking like, how do you become a couples expert? What does that even look like? And that's what prompted my research into the different types of licensure. And I was living out of state at the time, but I knew I would be moving to Louisville. So I was just poking around, and that's how I found this program. And it was really attractive to me that it was just couple and families. So yeah, it was meant to be.
Yeah, similarly, I didn't know about it as a standalone until I knew I wanted to pursue going back to grad school for therapy. And then I made a giant spreadsheet of all the different ways that you can become a therapist with pros and cons. And so it was like social work, like licensed clinical psychologist, PsyD, And then MFT, it took me a while to come across an MFT program in my research. But once I did, I was like, oh, this is the way that I see this work, is like through the lens of the system and not just the individual. So that I had some questions, honestly, when I first heard about it, about this feels like a smaller subsection of the field. And does that mean that it's like a less portable license? Does that mean that it is going to be like harder to get licensed? I just had some questions about the professional implications of that. But in terms of like the theoretical orientation, it was a really clear fit.
Yeah, I'm similar to a lot of folks here. I didn't really know much about the different options in terms of like directions you can go to be a therapist until I had really made that decision for myself. And I sat down and did a lot of research into like different positions and what the schooling is like, what job opportunities you would have if you take a specific direction. But I'm like pretty indecisive, so I can make lists all day long, but that really didn't help me very much. Luckily, I had some people that I knew that were therapists, and so I started to inquire with them about their experiences and strengths and things that they enjoyed about the programs that they were in, maybe versus some things that they didn't really care for. And that's really, for me, what solidified my decision was speaking to a friend of mine and talking about her experience in this program and the benefits to this type of license. And that just really spoke to me more than any of the research I was doing, and took the leap based on our conversations that we had.
Yeah, the big five mental health professions, MFT, this is the smallest. There's probably about five times as many LCSWs nationally as there are LMFT. So unless you come from a family studies undergraduate program, you probably do not get exposed to it. But you all did your homework and you found it. You also bring up some important points, which is really the main focus of our talk today. It's great when you're in your holding environment, in your protective container of your MFT program. But once you leave, what you need to do to become fully licensed is, it's quite another journey, which you all are on right now. And that's what our talk is about today. Depending on what state you live in, those 2 to 4 to 5 years post your MFT degree in order to get licensed. So let's start with that. Everybody in here is about a year out, except for Jennifer, who's 2 years out. So let's talk about what you think are some of the biggest challenges leaving, again, a nice furtive holding environment, a nest of your MFT program, and going into the real world to start your systemic therapy career.
So this is Allie again. I think, gosh, a couple come to mind. I think the first is not learning tangentially with practicing. That was something really helpful to me, just coming in every week, talking about the models, really keeping things fresh, and also being able to talk to my cohort mates. Hey, are you guys, has anybody had a couple like this? Or I have a family that's going through this, and to just have that support built in to the program and experience as a graduate student was so helpful. So I think that's probably been one of the biggest challenges for me transitioning from student to practicing therapist associate. Yeah, that's a big one for me too, actually. I found so much benefit in seeing clients while also like having classes where we're learning about models and interventions and hearing from our cohort mates about like sessions that they had and challenges they ran into and what they did. And it was like, oh, that's creative. That's a good idea. I want to try that with this client that I have. Like having that to fall back on, I guess, like when maybe you're feeling stuck in some regards, is such a wonderful safeguard to have that I definitely really miss. And it's also been hard because my caseload is a lot higher now. And so being able to balance prepping for my clients while also like making time for furthering my learning and my education on my own and like reading books and finding trainings and things like that while still maintaining time for myself and time for my partner and friends and family. That's been surprisingly a big challenge for me
too.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off of that a little bit because I totally agree. There's something really special about after you graduate, you can clearly seek consultation, but there's something special about having this built-in opportunity to talk to 16, 17 other people who are at the exact same point developmentally as you. So there's not, I don't know, it's just more free-flowing and it feels very easy. And so yeah, after the fact, once you graduate, you do have to be more intentional about it. And that's definitely been a struggle for me, but it's great to see people and speak to them when we can. And I know that our cohort has really tried to make those opportunities to connect. Another challenge for me has been pivoting to more of a business-oriented mindset, starting my own LLC. A lot of that stuff has felt really nightmarish to me. It feels like people aren't as willing to hold your hand around some of those things once you graduate because there is a lot of maybe nuances there. And so nobody wants to be accountable. So you do have to take it into your own hands. I remember first creating my LLC and getting an email with like 10 different checklist items. Make sure that you do this. And I got in my head, how many of these do I actually need to do? Just a lot of questions. And it's hard to know who do I go to with those questions. And when I do go to people, maybe I get conflicting opinions. So you have to really be prepared to stand on your own as a professional, even while leaning on other people.
Yeah, that's the case for me. I would say just the caseload increase was pretty substantial, going from being a student to now your full-time therapist. And primarily the work that I do is in a community mental health agency. So there is a lot of differences in maybe having a large caseload, and I work in a rural environment, and so I'm pretty much seeing a lot of different presentations throughout the day. So that was a pretty big thing. When I was thinking about this question, the phrase, the kid gloves come off, came to mind, because it's now you are a clinician and people are seeing you as that. Whereas when you're a student, there are a lot of safeguards. There's a lot of hand-holding. There's a lot of encouragement. And sometimes you just have to encourage yourself. Some days, like it's you versus you, and you have to encourage yourself that day. And so that was a big transition for me.
I want to say something that's the opposite of what some people have been saying. I have experienced, especially being doing contracting work and having my own business, that has been challenging because my caseload is low. And trying to build a caseload that way has been hard. You start to see the impact of things like all the snow and ice that Kentucky specifically had, weather things and sickness and just all these other variables that come into play and really impact your clients and you as a therapist. So that is something that has been challenging for me to consider. How long do I continue doing this? Do I get a second job? Do I go into something that's more like community-based where I know I'm going to be seeing people, but then I kind of risk the burnout? It's like, where is the middle ground? That is difficult, I think, especially as an associate when you're not fully licensed and you are really having to, it seems, really pick or choose from one challenging reality or another one in very different ways.
Yeah, I resonate with a lot of what people have said. And another thing that has just felt challenging is it feels like we were in this protected chute of this is the path. You chose the path. You're in the program. Like, we all know where we're going. And then you come out at the other end and there's 1,000 different directions that you can go in, both in terms of what kind of professional setting you want to be in, who you want to work with, how you want to specialize, where you want to get more training, like who you want to be your supervisor. Like where there's a pathway to licensure, but you can do it in a lot of different orders and everyone's going to choose their own. And so it's all of a sudden, there's just so many things that you're just ultimately responsible for choosing for yourself. And I really have a plan. So that's hard for me. And yeah, and I find that the balance of like where to seek more training and like where to grow professionally is really overwhelming in a way, because there's so many different ways to think about it. Like there are specific client presentations that I'm seeing a lot. Like I work with a lot of trans people, and so I see a lot of trauma. And so in one way, I'm like, oh, it's an extreme priority for me to get more tools for working with trauma because that's what is needed for the people in front of me. But theoretically, I'm like more interested in IFS and this sort of like deep psychic work kind of modalities. And so deciding where to go with that feels really challenging. It feels exciting too. Like it's a great thing to be really interested and overstimulated by how exciting this professional work is, but it is overwhelming. And something that I've been just in the first year out that I've been saying to myself a lot is my job right now is just to become as skilled and competent as I can with the tools that I have in my toolkit, and the rest will come with time. And just trusting that I don't have to figure it all out right now has been very helpful.
I wonder if you could talk about your experience finding a supervisor, negotiating time. Of course, the taboos, therapists don't like talking about money, how you negotiated that, and any tips you have for our listeners out there that are hitting the job market and the supervisor market.
My current supervisor is actually who I was receiving supervision from in the grad program. And I did my research. I found a few options that I might be interested in reaching out and finding more about. But it was really important to me that I went with a supervisor who I felt like I didn't need to be performative or sell myself or prove myself to. And that's, of course, like self of the therapist work. I'm sure there are a bunch of great supervisors out there where it wouldn't feel like that. But there was something really appealing to me about the idea of I knew his style, he knew my style. We were aligned in a lot of ways, but I also knew that I could be challenged and learn new things from his style of supervision since I was used to it. It looks a little different not receiving that supervision through school and having a separate relationship that way. But that's how I chose my clinical supervisor post-graduation.
Mine was a little different. So I actually, through my agency, I have a supervisor that they provide, and we get along really well, so that's great. And he is also an LCSW, which is the other license that I'm pursuing, so he was able to become secondary social work supervisor, which helped with my social work hours in addition to my MFT hours, so that was great. And then right when we were about to graduate and we were trying to find our supervisor, I had like a pie in the sky supervisor that I really wanted. And I was like, I'm just going to ask her. And she said yes. And I remember I was like, so excited. And so I was paying outside of the agency for an additional supervisor because I wanted to try to finish my hours as quickly as I could. And so I was paying her outside of the agency or soliciting her outside of the agency. And then she ended up not being able to do it for the second year. So then I was able to get a supervisor that was one of my professors, and he's excellent, and I love his supervision style, and we have a good relationship, so that was very good, too. So all in all, that was how I did it. I think for me, I guess my tip would be if you can, have that 8 hours of supervision a month. I think it's worth it because, just like humble brag, I'm almost done. July, it will be my LMFT month. So I'll have all my hours done. And so that's very exciting, but it was challenging. There were some challenges to it too, but definitely aligning with your supervisor is very important. The supervisor that I picked first, she had a very strong social justice background, very strong in diversity. And that was something that was very important to me. And so when she was supervising me, I was getting a lot of that because that was how she viewed things too. And then my supervisor is now, he is LMFT. And like I said, I'm familiar with his supervision style. And we also have very similar perspectives in how to do therapy. Like we both really love Virginia Satir's work. We both are really into narratives. So that there's a lot of things that just align. And so when I'm able to talk to him about some things and we see things similarly, in addition to him challenging me too.
Yeah, I think that's also how I approached it too, was lucky enough to have some wonderful supervisors in the program that I really connected to in a lot of ways. So it felt comfortable, but also felt like this supervisor I'm working with now, we had a lot of similarities in the way that we approached conceptualizing, but also thought that he was really well-versed in some of the areas that I thought that I was like weak in. Like always has an article for me to read or a book. It's very evidence-based, which can be my weakness at times. So I thought it was really beneficial to have a supervisor that you could connect to in a lot of ways, but also would push you to grow in areas that you needed to. I also think a helpful tip is to, depending obviously on like the financial aspects of things, I think it's really beneficial to have multiple supervisors, whether it be for individual or group or whatever, that are very different in style, or maybe have different, I guess, types of clients that they work with or different specialties. Because I think having those differing perspectives is imperative in making sure that you don't maybe get pigeonholed into one way of doing things. Obviously, there's like financial components to it, but typically like groups can be fairly cheaper, I think. And I'm currently searching for a group right now, so I don't have a lot of information to share yet. And unfortunately, I was limited in my options as well because I chose to take a break post-graduation. I didn't seek out employment until, gosh, I think 4 months later. So a lot of the folks that I was reaching out to, unfortunately, were already full and couldn't take me on. So that's also something to consider, like the timing of everything too. But definitely, I think it's important to have different perspectives on the work that you're doing.
Yeah. For me, my supervisor wasn't my supervisor in graduate school, but he was one of my professors. And so rapport really matters to me. And just knowing that he's someone that I get along with and that I feel comfortable with. I didn't necessarily want to be starting from scratch and building a relationship with a supervisor. So that was a major motivator for me. And another thing that pushed me in his direction is that I'm looking for supervision from someone who is walking a path that I might want to walk. So the fact that he has experience as a business owner and can vet some of those, I really get lost in the weeds sometimes with some of the technicalities and the minutia. So just knowing that this is someone who's actually relatively new to Kentucky. So he's learning a lot of things and it's fresh in his brain. I can absorb that from him. And he's also a professor, and that's something that I'm not making any promises here, but that's something that appeals to me as well. He's walked down the PhD path. So those are all factors that really matter to me because it's helpful to have somebody kind of walking alongside you who knows the path and can kind of show you the way.
Totally. I really resonate with that. My main supervisor is also the owner of the practice that I'm working at, and it's included in my employment contract. So that was a major perk, but it's also, I really like and respect her and wanted her as a supervisor too. So the reasons I want to work here are similar to the reasons that I wanted to work with her as a supervisor. And some of that is that like long-term, I have dreams of starting a like queer and trans health center, mental health practice, and working with somebody who has like the experience of starting a business that is really social justice oriented was really appealing to me, to get to hear like what it's like to be a clinician and run the business and navigate all of those challenges. And then it was also important to me to find a second supervisor, both for all the reasons everyone has said, and also to have a supervisor who is not also my boss, just to have somewhere else to talk about work, because there is a dynamic of being supervised by someone who works in the same place or who is your employer or whatever it may be. So I've, both for the hours and for the difference in perspective, have appreciated having two.
My supervisor, he was my supervisor year one, semester one of the program that I went through, and he saw like all of those really embarrassing moments where you have no clue what you're doing and you're clearly feeling anxious and just doing weird stuff. And so I felt just like really safe. I'm like, okay, he knows when I say I'm nervous or you're going to see me do the thing. He knows like what that is. And that was really important to me. And also I felt like the relationship with him had been established enough to the point where I felt like I can challenge him a little bit. If I need something and I feel like I'm not getting it or whatever, like I feel like I can be like, hey,
I need this, or have that conversation. And that was really important to me too.
In listening to you all, there are some themes that you prefer to comfort. And as you were just saying, Hillary, so you knew someone so you could already have that alliance so they could push you and you could push them. Other people are looking for people that are just a good clinically fit for they want to learn. And then things outside of the domain of theory or technique, the business savvy and sense. Frankie talks about the importance of having a secondary supervisor as well. For those of you listening and you say, oh man, I in my geographic area or I'm going somewhere new, I don't have that built-in relationship. The tip I always give is the best way you're interviewing for a job. You interview the supervisors. What are you looking for? And if right now you're listening to this and you don't have one yet. So you have to think, what are you looking for? And some people want somebody that's cheap. Now, we didn't talk about cost. I did ask that. I'm not asking you, depending on which region of the country you're in, it's different, but it doesn't seem like that was awkward for any of you all. And obviously, I think Maddie was referencing, if you're doing group supervision, which MFT is interesting in that they consider individual supervision one or two. So it can be a dyad and still count as individual supervision, which always was somewhat confusing for me in 25 years in my career. It still is confusing. And then groups, I think, oh boy, don't quote me. I think 3 to 7 is what is considered a group. It's interesting also, not only the cost, but what you get and including AAMFT approved supervision. So if you're out again, if you have a state board approved supervision, it could be wonderful supervisors. But in general, before I turn it over to the panel, AAMFT approved supervision is a credential you have probably more than any other discipline. The way MFT trains its supervisors. And if you're listening out there, it is their supervision is supervised for, they take a large didactic course, an in-person course with a program of study. And there's a culminating project, which we can mention in a second. And their supervision, the supervision of supervision, supervision squared. As a MFT student, your supervisor, their supervision is supervised by a senior supervisor. So it takes a lot to get AAMFT approved supervisor status. But if you get it, as much as you graduate from a co-AMFT program, that you're not going to have any problems when you go in front of the licensure board. It is highly unlikely anyone is going to question the quality of your supervision. Just knowing you all, I know all of you are getting AAMFT approved postgraduate supervision. But anybody want to say anything about negotiating a fee?
I didn't. That's what I have to say. I didn't. I do supervision actually with Jeffrey. So we do the dyad thing and that helps with the cost. So of the route that we took.
I didn't either. I felt like it was fair. Actually more than fair, really. But if I think about the cost or the supervision that I paid for it. Now, for my agency, typically they will only pay for one supervisor. And I was able to talk about the benefits of me being both. And that helped them to make the decision to pay for my MFT as well. So I have an MFT and a CSW supervisor or social work supervisor that the agency pays for.
Yeah, my supervision is not reimbursed or paid for. So in terms of like tips for current students who are set to graduate soon, definitely do the math, figure out if you can swing it. There's also something to think about, like at my practice, there's, I guess it's like a consult group that it runs every week and there are lots of moving parts. Like you have to have a contract in place with your supervisor. If you don't have that contract in place that's approved by the board, then even if an LMFT is running that supervision group, you can't count those hours. So that's, I guess, why I'm framing it more as a consult group. It's helpful. We can talk about cases. We can conceptualize. We can hear qualified therapist thoughts, but we can't count it towards our hours accrual. So that's something to think about as well, I think.
I guess I did maybe a little bit in terms of, I don't know if I just got lucky though, but it was definitely like a very open conversation between my supervisor and I, and something that like you shouldn't shy away from asking about. But I think because I started a bit later and a lot of the folks here already were paying a certain amount for their supervision, even though they had like dyads or groups and mine is individual, because we knew each other and because that was the rate that he was charging them, he was okay with us like coming down a little bit. So mine did get cheaper, which was nice. And then I was also able to, in my interviews here, just talk about what my non-negotiables were and like things that I was willing to negotiate on, and also just talked with my current boss about the importance of having some sense of stability up front, because it can take a long time, as we've mentioned, to build a caseload depending on where you are and what the needs are there. So luckily, I was also able to negotiate with my boss a stipend for supervision that covers my monthly supervision with my current supervisor in full. So I did some negotiating, but I think there was also some benefit to just knowing this person previously and having already a standard fee that was less than what we had talked about originally. Yeah.
Yeah. Before we move off of supervision, just another few tips. If you don't have an in like our friends on the panel had, you didn't know somebody, you can, first of all, go to your state's licensure board, and there should be a list of all both board approved and AMFT approved supervisors on that list, which would give you a starting point. And then, much like I said, like many people write a theory of change or a culminating project of how they view systemic therapy, and AMFT approved supervisors also have to do the same thing. It used to be called a epistemological declaration, a theory of philosophy of supervision, where if written correctly, this is what you do during your period of becoming an AAMFT approved supervisor candidate. So that's also, if you see that term out there, if you're in our audience, that person is getting their supervision currently supervised, but they could also supervise you and it would still count in your postgraduate hours. So that philosophy of supervision paper should tell you everything, how they look at their major theories, how people change and get stuck. It should tell you how they structure their supervision, how they give feedback, how they pay attention to cultural diversity, and again, how they evaluate. So I would highly recommend, even though our panel didn't have to do that, asking when you interview a potential supervisor to see their philosophy of supervision paper. It should be something they're proud of, and AMFT approved supervisors have to get their credential, have to get continuing education every 7 years, take a course. And during a course, they're supposed to update their philosophy of supervision paper. So I would highly recommend that out there if you're trying to decide, is this person going to be a good fit for me? Okay, when you guys were talking about challenges post-graduation, you did not name the biggest two. And ones from our AMFT listeners of the AMFT podcast, I get questions about all the time. Post-graduation, to get licensed, and again, we are all in Kentucky here, but depending on the state you're in, it may be a little different, but there's three components that you need post-graduate. You need supervision, which we just talked about, and you need clinical hours, face-to-face clinical hours, and in your setting, it is important. Sometimes it is a number of just total face-to-face hours, depending on the state. Sometimes it's a number of individual versus couple or family, i.e. relational hours. But the one big one that everybody worries about that no one has mentioned yet is the test. Unless you're in California, which many of our listeners are, but unless you're in California, you're taking the AMFTRB national exams, which, when I got into the field and when I took that test, I got into the field 25 years ago, and there was not a provisionary license, an associate level license. So you had to wait till you'd accrued all your hours, till everything else. You had to take the test at the very end. So for the quickest you could do it is like 2 years, and the most you could do would be like 5 years when I got licensed in Illinois. Now, every state has a provisionary license, which means you can take that test right away. So no one mentioned the test, but people are going to ask about it. So your thoughts on the test and certainly preparing for it, when to take it, how to study for it, because that is going to be probably the biggest fear and worry of people listening to our talk today.
I'm signed up to take it in 2 weeks. That's definitely on my mind. The advice that everyone gave me was, and gave all of us, I know because we were all in the same program, is take it as soon as possible, which was my goal. I think Hillary and Jeffrey succeeded in taking it basically right away, which kudos to you all. But my experience was that some of the difficulties that our state board have been having have impacted the ability to sign up. So I tried to sign up quite a while ago, and there was a delay, and a 4-month delay in getting a registration code. So just that's another challenge.
That is actually a good thing to share to many of our people listening, because even if you do everything you should do, you're now at the mercy of a body that you don't know much about or hard to communicate with.
Sorry. Yeah. And to be honest, that's been one of the challenges of like post-graduation, trying to navigate the professional world is coming into it at a time where there's just a lot of instability in our state governing body. And a lot of fellow clinicians have been having issues. There was like a lapse in my supervision for a while because of licensing stuff. And yeah, it's just, it's challenging to like exit the cocoon of being in grad school and then have to navigate, like you said, like being like totally at the mercy of a board that's out of your hands. And I'm still just getting to know what the role of that board is and like how to communicate with the board and what's typical and is this typical? I hope not. Doesn't seem like it. But yeah, so that was one of the challenges in taking the exam. But now signed up for it and it's been really helpful. I have a little study group that is meeting every couple weeks, and that's been a very helpful way to balance like wanting to make space to refresh and study, but also having a lot to manage right now. It's hard to find, to carve out space and time for that.
I have taken the tests. And so for the way I studied was using a video training that was just all of the models. It talked about assessment, diagnosis. She was pretty much all of the areas that you would need to know for the test. And then I also utilized a book from my grad school program that was helpful too. And so my supervisor through the agency, he was very big on take the test as soon as possible. And that was something that was helpful with my supervisor, was kind of always asking, like, have you taken the test yet? Have you taken the test yet? And then also supervisors helping you study for the test too. So that was my method. Now, I am not ashamed to admit that unfortunately, I did not pass the test. I missed one point, and that got me having to take it over. And so that was very crushing, honestly. But it's something that I have to take the test, right? So it's like, you can't just say, oh man, I'm not going to take this test. No, you have to take it. So going back to when you take the test, they print off a report that shows you your areas where you're really strong and the areas where you could improve. So all I've been doing is focusing on the areas to improve, in addition to just breezing through the areas where I was strong in. So then that way, when I do retake it, that I feel confident. But when I took it, I felt very confident. And I feel like my score reflected that I knew the material based on what I did. So that's what I did. And I think I would say try to take it as soon as possible so you do, that information is fresh, because the test really is a knowledge-based test. So it's like you have to know the information. And so if you take it as close to when you graduated as possible, that's going to be, I think, more beneficial than waiting. It is a long test. And I think halfway through, I was like, get me out of here. I can't take it anymore. But I obviously did. So it's a good to just be prepared for it. And also, I think I'm a part of some Facebook groups too, where they will post questions sometimes, or people across the country. We're all taking the same test. We can support each other across the country. And there was also one other app that I used called, I can't think of it, Pocket Prep, where they would just ask you questions. And then I took some practice tests too. I did not take the official practice test of the test, but when I took the Pocket Prep practice test and the practice test that was in the book, I did really well. And so I felt pretty confident when I took it.
Yeah, I'll say that for me, it definitely was a priority to take it as quickly as possible. I think for two reasons, and Jennifer definitely touched on one of them, which is it's as fresh as it's ever going to be when you're right out of the program. And so I was acutely aware of that, acutely aware of the fact that as I do jump into new chapters of life, those things erode pretty quickly. And another big motivator for me was that I also thought that it was probably easier than it would ever be, just in terms of the fact that I was building my caseload, things were moving slowly. And from my perspective, I'd rather take it when I've got 7 or 8 clients that I see a week versus 20 clients a week, or maybe even more than that. And yeah, that was definitely a major motivator. In terms of studying, I definitely used the exam guide that I also looked at in grad school. I felt pretty prepared by my program, so I think that was also a perk, and I really wanted to maintain that momentum. And then I know, Eli, I know you're ready for me to talk about this, one of my major idiosyncratic ways of preparing. I've always been somebody who can hold on to things better if I can take what I'm learning and then convert it into some kind of creative output. So I'm also a musician, really interested in lyrics. And so I thought that maybe it would help me drill things into my brain by making an MFT kind of history rap. You guys can hear some of that at the end of this, but I did think that it was genuinely helpful. Sometimes I have test anxiety, I freeze, I dissociate. It's hard to pull up that material, but being able to play a beat in my head and then go line by line, okay, here's the chronology, here's who goes with what model. Not that I expect everyone out there to follow in my footsteps, but maybe you can benefit secondhand from my labor and drill it into your own heads.
So without further ado, let's listen to Jeffrey and his wife Hillary with the backing vocals and the MFT rap. Now, audio-only version of this podcast is still very helpful, but what you also want to do, I want to make this video go viral. Go to YouTube and just type in MFT rap, and you'll see the really powerful visuals that go with Jeffrey's original song. So the broadcast debut of the MFT rap.
This is a journey through time. Let's begin.
Story starts on a Freudian couch. They would analyze your symptoms while ignoring your spouse. But some renegades were questioning conventional wisdom. Like, what if we expanded the system? In the 50s, Nathan Ackerman was leading the troops. Murray Bowen stirred up systems just like heating up soup. John Bell was seeing families with treatments from group. And Greg Bateson, he was thinking in loops. This negative feedback when a system is strained. Homeostasis is the name of the game, keep it maintained. There's positive feedback that cannot be contained. Just like a runaway train, and it's bringing some change. Down in Palo Alto, Basin rallied a team. Don Jackson, Jay Haley, and John Weeklin would scheme to use communication theory as a way to uncover a source of schizophrenia.
Let's try blaming the mother.
This is the history of MFT.
Moms isn't cute. The crew became the Mental Research Institute, strategically preparing paradoxical traps. But in the 70s, Mnuchin put the field on the map. He was structural, custom rules and roles were too rigid. Making a name in Philly with the Child Guidance Clinic. Satir and Whitaker, experiential and authentic. It was a battle of the brands, and which ego was the biggest. Then the postmodern pivot, and the 80s, Gulishin and Anderson. Collaborative language systems, operating from a not knowing position. We're conversation partners, I am not your physician. Stephen and Sue would use the miracle question. So solution focused like hypnotic suggestion. White co-authored narratives, the women's group wondered. Carter and McGoldrick like, really? The mothers?
This is the history of MFT.
Yeah.
The recipe.
Both the Gottmans emerged in the Love Lab, observing whenever horsemen occurred. Ansel Johnson up in Canada was making a scene. The EFT queen saw attachment was key. Dick Schwartz was dreaming up a treatment state of the art.
eternal family systems with the self and the parts. Although we're all relying on the egos of giants, today we gotta integrate the art with some science. There's manuals and methods and there's meta-analysis. We evaluate the evidence and craft our best practices, blending therapist acumen packaged with common factors. So listen up when Dr. Karam chats with the masters.
Jeffrey, that was outstanding. Please go to YouTube, type in MFT rap, Jeffrey Hilton, give that some love. Thank you, our listeners. Maddie, you may be able to use that to study with.
Yeah, I haven't taken the test yet, so that will definitely be one of my resources, Jeffrey. Because you can't take it until you have your provisional license, and I took a break naturally. Once I started, it felt like a priority for me to just get back into the swing of things and find stable footing with my new practice and getting to know the folks around here and like setting up my office and all of that stuff. And then once I felt good with that, my decision to still not take it was impacted by some of the nuances with the board that Frankie was talking about. So yeah, I have yet to take it. So I guess I'm playing the role of a listener now too, of like how best to approach it, and would love to be a part of your study group, Frankie, if you want to share the details.
I feel like I was honestly just so lucky, and seemed to, the image that I keep having is like a garage door closing and like a bird just like slips right in the garage, but before it closes, I feel like I'm that bird. And I was able to get whatever I needed to take the test from the board very early on, and took it last September. So not many months after graduating, and that was a huge priority for me. My caseload was super low, still trying to get footing there. So like Jeffrey said, wanted to capitalize on that and capitalize on, I'm still in the mode of studying and devoting myself to learning and taking tests and things like that. So it was a lot of luck, but yeah, definitely a priority for me to do it, and very happy I passed. So I forgot that the test was a thing when you said that, Eli. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, that's of course a big question. But yeah, trying to live in the moment and forget that happened, because it was really hard. It's a hard test. I took the practice one that you can buy on their website. That was probably the most helpful thing I did. It, like Jennifer was saying, like you can see what you did. Well, when you take the test too, it also shows you like the areas that you did better in and what you didn't do as well in. Practice test gives that to you also. However, when I took the real test, the things I did well in were not the things I did well in the practice one. I don't know.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm just curious, what's the turnaround for getting your scores back? Like, how long did that take?
Maybe 3 weeks or so.
Mine was pretty quick because I took it at the end of the testing window. So I actually got mine, I think, in 4 or 5 days. I think you have to wait longer if you take it at the beginning of the testing window, because then they're open for a few weeks. So then you have to wait for everybody who's taking that same exam to have to complete the test, and then they all go to be scored. I thankfully did not have to wait very long.
And they send you like an email first that says your test scores are being populated or something, and you think it's a score, but it's not. And then later on, you actually get the thing, and it's encrypted. You have to put a password in, and then that sheet expires. So it's if you want to keep it, you got to download it, print it off, or it goes away after a certain period of time.
Okay. Another big thing that people talk about in addition to the test, which you all didn't mention, is the paperwork. And every state has different types of paperwork, but there are some commonalities, something to track hours, to track supervision, to document. Again, if you come from an accredited program, it becomes much easier to verify your course of study. What tips do you all have on maintaining paperwork post-graduate?
If you're in a private practice, after you have supervision, record your hour immediately. So that is what I would say. I've been using just the board provided documentation or to document. And so I find that in my agency work, it's really easy to go and look. If I forget to jot something down, I can easily just go pull my calendar and see where I had supervision. because it's very routine. Like with my agency supervisor, it's every single week, every 2 weeks for 2 hours, we're going to meet on this day unless we don't. So that's pretty set in stone. But with the outside agency supervisor, sometimes that's different just because typically the outside agency supervisor is, they've got a lot of other things going on. And so sometimes the date might change. And so that was something that I had to learn pretty quickly, was just to make sure that I documented the hour. Also, if your supervisor has like a really good system, like the outside agency supervisor I have now, he bills me through his practice. So I get an invoice that, like a paid invoice, and then I can use that to track as well. It's also advised by my unit manager to always keep records of your own for yourself. My agency supervisor, he will send like a summary of what we discussed. I print that off and I keep that with my things because that's my responsibility to do. It's not his responsibility to necessarily keep up with that. So if at the end of this, I need that documentation, he's very like efficient, so I know he would have it, but I don't want to even kind of risk that. So I want to make sure that I have my own things as well.
Yeah, I really second that. Yeah, I basically, in the window when I was like, my caseload was really slow, which if you have a window like that, it felt really helpful to like use it to get some systems in place for tracking. So I like went on our state e-services and just explored everything and was like, okay, how do I submit continuing education? How do I submit supervision? How does this work? And then I downloaded the supervision paperwork and created a Google spreadsheet that just has all the same fields because I find that easier to use. So I have my own, like every month I create a new one and it has all the fields that are required in the official documentation. So it's like easy to transfer it over. And I just try to make sure that I do that every time I have supervision, because like you said, Jennifer, it's like, it's, if there's not another place that it's being reported, it's our responsibility to track that. And it's easy to lose track of it. And like, where those hours are so precious, we need to make sure that we get credit for them. So yeah, that's how I've been doing it. And I think it was so helpful. Something that our program did, thank you, Dr. Eli, was walk us through. We had to submit our like application for the associate's permit as part of a project before graduating. And that was so helpful because we like got to lean on each other and guidance from our professors for what needs to be included in that paperwork. And I verbatim took what I submitted for that project and then submitted it to the board and it got approved. So that was great. That was very helpful. So if you're not so lucky to be in a program that's like asking you to do that, then I might go ahead and do it anyway and get your professor's opinion on it while you still can.
That's so good. Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like lucky because the program, I feel like, it also, our program gave like a tracker, a spreadsheet tracker during the program to track your supervision hours and your client hours and all the relational stuff and all that stuff that you need. And so I basically just like copied that and I used that. I like adjusted the formulas for myself to make it make sense for what I'm doing now, but I just use the same exact tracker and do that. I will say there have been times where I have not recorded immediately after supervision, but thankfully I have everything like on my calendar that I use like to see clients and also to do supervision. It's all in one place. There's been a couple days where I've just taken an hour or two and gone through and put everything in. And so that has been helpful, at least to have a calendar where everything is consolidated so that if I do miss something, because I know myself, what will happen, I have a little backup system. But yeah, doing it as you go, I think is huge. And the documentation piece of it gave me a lot of stress when we were getting ready to graduate. So I appreciated being able to do it with everybody and work through that together. I think the piece that we weren't able to work through necessarily in school was like the supervision contract. And that was stressful too. I remember texting everyone, how did you put this? Making sure that it was up to snuff. And that was stressful, but yeah, got through it.
Yeah, if you're listening and you haven't done one of those yet, many states have what is called a plan of supervision. So the licensing board wants to know how the supervision is going to occur, how often, what is the setup, which they will approve. The setting where you are going to be getting your clinical work is on that in many states' paperwork. So yeah, at the University of Louisville, we prepare this soon-to-be graduates of the things they'll need to not just survive, but hopefully thrive on the way to licensure. And we have to put that together in an assignment. I'm writing an article about that course right now. So if you haven't had that, other things you could do if you're in the audience, yeah, definitely identifying the paperwork and going to the state, as Frankie was telling us, the state licensing board. Some are organized better than others, but should have all of the paperwork and all the requirements for an MFTA or a provisionary license if your state calls it something different. And also on that, a lot of times, yes, you have to get continuing education. So another thing would be a good thing to do, we have our students do, look at how much continuing education you need in what categories, meaning like most states have an ethics requirement every year. Sometimes you have to have so many of this, so many of that. And then where are the best places to get those? Obviously, you can get those at AAMFT. They're going to be, again, always approved. But you want to make sure before you spend money or time in your training or continuing education that the licensure board will approve it. That's a very frustrating thing. If you do that, and even if you learn something, if you've spent money on it, it doesn't count. So we have people do that to prepare. We have people prepare in mock interviews, which we won't have time to talk about today, but everybody here got a job very quickly, but some people may not. And even Maddie, who took, in the grand scheme of things, 4 months is a very short amount of time, but even Maddie was able to get a job very quickly. And so if you're out there and you're not, and you've been struggling to get a job, I think it's would be important to make sure the agency or setting wherever you're interviewing understands what an MFT is if you were the only in one in that area, which is what we also do, prepare our students how to portray what it means to be a systemic individual couple and family therapist in MFT. It's not just seeing couples and families. Obviously, we know that. We're preaching to the choir in our audience, but many employers or stakeholders don't necessarily know that. So I guess you all have been so informative. We always also get a lot of questions. You work very hard in a graduate program, but you do have a cohort, and not everybody is lucky to have a cohort, as you all have spoken about, and certainly that is a protective factor. So I don't want those people out there that did not have that experience with their cohort to feel bad, but it is important to stay connected to a community of systemic thinkers once you leave. So thoughts on that, and then a catch-all of work-life balance. Do you find, now that you're not writing papers or taking tests, do you find it's easier to have a work-life balance? But your thoughts on that, when we fall that under the general category of self-care, which is important at any stage of your career. But obviously, if you don't develop those habits early, even if you're a talented clinician, a much larger chance of burning out. So your thoughts on community and self-care.
I feel like they're one and the same for me. I feel when you're starting off on your own, it's very overwhelming. And oftentimes, like if you don't have those like meetings or check-ins built into the structure of where you're working, it can be isolating and you don't want to be navigating those feelings alone. So I feel like being very intentional about creating community, and like our cohort has been really good at that and regularly checks in with each other, even if we can't get together physically. There's also a lot of, or there's Facebook groups and things like that for networking purposes. And a lot of times that's like the first place that I'll see like updated information and stuff. So it's nice not only for that sense of community, but also just like continuing education too, in a way, and like a place where I can look to then do my further research into other things and other updates and stuff. But yeah, self-care is definitely a challenge so far because my caseload expectations are quite high. I have to have 32 slots available every week, which feels like a lot. And it's hard when you're here all day. You just want to go home and veg out. But if you get into the routine of doing that, it really does start to weigh on you, both
in your personal life and as a therapist. I've had to be really intentional about scheduling things in. Like after this, for example, I booked myself a massage for an hour, which I haven't been able to do in a while. So like doing things like that, right? Or sometimes just like saying yes to like being social when I don't have the energy, but I know that will be fulfilling, is so worth it. So really it's about just being intentional with those practices and like scheduling them into your routine as best you can.
I love that. And that's similar to me, especially really big on the saying yes more than saying no. Because it's very easy to say no, because you're, of course, listening to yourself if you're really tired. But if you could hang out, or if you could respond to the text or things like that, to do that. So that's a way that I've been in community. There are a couple of people from my cohort that I, when I graduated, that I talk to regularly or go out to dinner with. And so that's helpful. Just my friends, like that I was friends with before all of this, spending time with them, my family, prioritizing my family. I have my nieces and nephews who I call my broke best friends. Like, my niece, are we doing all kinds of stuff together? That's very fun. And then really just like my partner, like being able to go and do things on the weekends too. So I've certainly gotten a lot better with community. I think this whole experience has humbled me a lot. Just in that I cannot do everything by myself. And I definitely had this mentality that it's like, I got this. I can do it by myself. I don't need anybody to help me. And I'm in a space now where I'm like, no, I definitely need people to help me. And I've gotten a lot better at asking for help and saying I don't have it and allowing other people to be there for me. Instead of me feeling like I've got to be there. So that's been really helpful with community and my self-care, my own mental health. As far as other elements of self-care, just eating healthier has been a big thing for me. Working out, I've been like going to the gym at 5 a.m. and I really like that. And being able to do that before work, I've probably changed my schedule 3 times. Since working at the community mental health agency, and this 3rd time is like perfection. So I get off now at 4 instead of 7 every night, having a 2 jobs. Basically, I stopped taking on some clients at my private practice for my own mental health. And so now it's like, I feel like I have a healthy balance, and it took me a long time to get to that place, but it feels really good to have gotten there now. And then once you get there, you're like, okay, I got it. It's almost like the Hobbit, like my precious. I got to keep this. I don't want to make myself feel stressed anymore. I definitely say no. Like, I'll say yes to hanging out, and I say no to like tasks. If I don't have to do it, I'm not going to. If it's not Jennifer does not have to do it and someone else can do it, then you can do it. And that has really been, even me talking about it, I just feel peace just talking about it. Those are the things that have been really helpful for me. And I've always said at the beginning of this program, when self-care is talked about so much, and I was just like, that's not that big of a deal. We don't need it that much. Self-care, take a bubble bath, whatever. It's like, no, you actually really legitimately need to take care of yourself. And when you do, you can be the best version of yourself, not only for you or your clients, but for everyone. Everyone experiences you better.
I love what you just said, Jennifer, about the importance of making sure that you're taking care of yourself so you don't burn out. Because like, I always think like, you can't pour from an empty cup. You need to be approaching your clients as full of a person as you can be. At least that's how I think of it. I always want to show up to a session and be able to give my best. And I think I'm constantly reminding myself that I can't give them my best if I'm not okay. So one way like I try to maintain that work-life balance is I learned through grad school that something that helps me is to stack my clients. So I have 3 long days, but I only work 3 days a week. And for now, that's sustainable. I get my 3 days of heavy clients and then 2 days to take a breather, catch up, make sure all of my notes are submitted and all that documentation is good, and then to wind down and relax. So I think that's something that I've learned
for now is sustainable. For now, it works for me. Yeah, I think I could definitely also be better about pushing myself to be more social and connect with people outside of FaceTiming my sister and leaning on my husband. I think something else, like listening to both of you talk about your caseloads and finding that sweet spot, is my caseload is on the lighter side. And at times I've felt some guilt about that, like wondering what could I do to increase how many clients I'm seeing. But then that fear kicks in of what if I burn out? So I think a big part of my own self-care has been going to therapy myself and working through just this is something that works for me. This number that I'm at is working for me now. And having that be okay and just grounding myself in that. And if I need to make a change down the road, then I'll know that when the time comes. But I can't be an effective therapist if I'm exhausted and burnt out and have compassion fatigue. That's not the answer to seeing more clients and getting myself to that place where I'm so worn down that I don't care. I feel really grateful that I can approach all my clients for the most part and feel full and have the ability to lock in and be present with them and give them like my full undivided attention. And that's something that I just know I wouldn't be able to do if I had such a full caseload. So I think just always reminding myself and circling back to that right now I'm effective and that's what matters.
Yeah, I think for me, self-care has always been an area of growth, something that I'm still working on. I'm somebody who likes to have multiple things going on at once and just like to feel really engaged. And if this thing's getting boring, I can pivot my head and look over here. So even throughout grad school, I had a second job so that I could be bringing in money while I was learning. And I still have that job today as I'm working on building up my caseload. And I can see a time in the future, hopefully the near future, where that changes. But right now, that's the situation. So yeah, that's difficult. I really like the theme in this conversation, though, of saying yes versus saying no. And I always tell myself that I say yes to too many things and I need to say no more. But I think really it's more about what you're saying yes to. Like every no is an implicit yes. I would like to say yes more to building community and seeing my friends and say no more to the just like pure grinding and pure tasks that I can get lost in. So that's something that I'm going to hold on to kind of moving out of this conversation. Other small ways that I've been improving at self-care is just going on walks. I've been trying to increase my step count to be a little more physically healthy, be more intentional about what I'm eating, how indulgent I am, but still making space for indulgence. Those little things, bubble baths. Somebody said it earlier, and I would highly endorse a bubble bath at least on occasion. And then I like to be creative, and I really have been working on music lately. So finding space for that part of myself, I think of as a form of self-care as well.
Yeah, I appreciate all of that and have felt a lot of resonance, especially with finding space for balancing out your caseload and like figuring out what the schedule is that works for you. I started out trying to stack clients and have 3 heavy days and only work 4 days total. And I found that did not work for me at all. So I have switched and now I have 5 and sometimes 6 days, but that are like lighter, and that just works better for me. So experimenting with it has been helpful.
This has been great. There is so much more areas we could go further in depth in, but I want to give you all a chance to really say what you want and close to the early career professionals that are going to listen to this. And it could be anything about something you wish you would have known, or another tip, or just something that resonates with you and sits with your system currently. I'm going to start with Frankie on that and we'll go from there.
Yeah, we were just talking about self-care, and something that has been really present for me with self-care is like the environment for trans people and for a lot of marginalized people right now, and spending a lot of time like sitting with my clients in fear and uncertainty and like chain and actively losing access to rights and to supports. Our state government just passed a bill that restricts Medicaid from covering any gender affirming care, including, which impacts therapy too, like people who are receiving treatment with a gender dysphoria diagnosis. and like making space in myself to hold that for and with and alongside clients some days feels really hard and also feels incredibly important and powerful. And it's felt very important to me to have to be really connected to my community, and I can provide a container for people who are going through it. And then I need that container too for myself. And I want to talk a little bit too about the, what I feel is our responsibility to clients and to our ethics in this time. Seeing a lot of people in the healthcare professions pull away from providing services to trans folks, like being really afraid of the repercussions and preemptively complying with things that haven't actually even been asked, that we're not required to do, and not providing services when we actually legally and ethically still can and ethically must and need to. So those are all things that I was not really expecting to navigate in year one of being a therapist. And like, we live in the world, and so we're building our capacity to roll with what's happening around us as our clients do that and as everybody does that. And yeah, I think that's all I really want to say.
I appreciate how the macro systems affect the micro systems and affect our internal systems as therapists. And I appreciate you speaking up. Okay, the rest of you guys, what do you want? Any other last tips, things you wish who or want somebody else to know, or just however you want to end our really generative talk here today that I know so many people will hopefully take so many good things away as they continue their journey toward licensure?
Yeah. For me, I've noticed a trend among many people in my cohort and in other therapists that I've met that as a collective, we seem pretty hard on ourselves and that we push ourselves a lot. And self-compassion has been something that I've really had to prioritize over the program and now in this new career. And it's difficult. I've had clients who've talked to me about self-compassion, and it's almost like noise. Okay, that I don't have enough of that in my own life, so I can't really hear that. Let's talk about something else. And you've got to be able to embody it to a certain degree in order to help people get where they want to be as well. And so providing that for yourself is huge. It is such a transition to go. Being a student in and of itself is a really difficult and challenging period of time, but then making that pivot after graduating is challenging in its own way. So just continually having compassion for yourself and understanding that it's a process, and that you're not going to be the therapist that you would ideally like to be right out the gate, but you can be the person who's developing the habits to carry you where you want to go. And then to touch on a bit of what Frankie said, I think that we do live in a world right now where things feel very shaky and very uncertain. And it seems possible that a lot of these like larger institutions could just crumble around us. And that's a place where I feel like we are really doing like the work of a lifetime, where, you know, I imagine that like whatever arises from the ashes of the chaos that we're currently in, it has to come from those one-on-one relationships and the community that forms from that. So being able to provide people with space to connect with each other authentically and to build those skills, I think I feel so lucky to be in a position to do that. And so I hope that other people can feel that as well, that this is really important work in a world that's fragmented and fractured, to not only tend to your own internal system and make yourself feel coherent and clear and authentic, but then to be able to create space for that for other people. It's incredible.
I feel like you just stole a lot of the words out of my mouth, which is really awesome. But the word that was like on the tip of my tongue was self-compassion as well. And something I've noticed, and I picked up on this in my program, that something that I do is whatever I am trying to like give to my clients, or the things I'm saying to them, are so often what I need. And so I think that would be something, a piece of advice, is what are you trying to give to your clients? Is there anything in particular? And you might need that. For me, I think that is self-compassion. And I have done a lot of purposeful work in the last, I don't know, 6+ months to give myself that and to really understand what self-compassion means, and connecting to just the common humanity of there is suffering, there is pain, there is challenge, and there's also beauty and joy, and that we all experience all of those things. That helps me get through those tough moments as a therapist where you feel not confident and you feel like an imposter,
which makes sense because we're just sweet little flowers blooming for the first time in this profession. We're very early on. So of course we're going to feel like we don't know what we're doing, because in a lot of ways we might not to be scary, but we also do have the training and the education that your average person doesn't. And you are the expert in a lot of ways, even when you feel like you might not be.
Yeah, I resonated with a lot of what you all have said. And I think I just want to normalize. Sometimes it can feel like you're trying to, drink out of a fire hose. It feels like there's so much and you're just trying to like grasp at straws. And yeah, it's normal to feel overwhelmed. It's normal to have that imposter syndrome feeling. And just to remember, if you're in this position, then you've graduated, you've done it. You're right where you're supposed to be, and confidence will come with time. So yeah, I think I'll keep it short and sweet and just leave it at that.
I feel like, I keep thinking about self-care too, because a lot of what we're saying, like, this work is really heavy and hard sometimes. And we're also people who are operating under the same systems and the same struggles that a lot of our clients are experiencing. And I think in a lot of ways we talk about self-care as like these like big things, but self-care is really also just like small acts of service for yourself, like extending self-compassion. If you have a really hard session with someone, like choosing to take your 5 minutes to have some like deep breaths instead of writing your note is an act of self-care. And so being okay with doing those things and just being patient with where you are, because I promise everything that you're feeling, like everyone is saying, is totally normal. And just trust the process, because Jennifer was saying too, it takes time to find that. And so it's hard, but develop a discomfort or a comfort with the discomfort as you're like finding your process with things. Like, hard, but you're on the right track.
All right. So I have six short bullet points of six things that I've learned. And so the first thing is caseload management. We don't have enough time to talk about that, but write it down and don't forget. Because that was like, it took me way too long to learn how to manage my caseload to where it worked for me. And once I was able to get that down, a lot of my stress evaporated. And so that was very important. Time management was very important too. What's the best use of my time? Also advocating for myself, especially in an agency setting, being able to not only advocate for the things that I need as a person, but also the things that I need as a MFT. Also, just remember you're still practicing. So similar to the theme that you all have been saying, is that self-compassion and releasing some of that pressure off of yourself, is that every day we go into this room, into our therapy offices, we're literally still practicing. And utilize supervision, utilize the training, trust yourself as a therapist. The other thing, which kind of goes back to what Jeffrey was saying about self-care, is don't stop learning about yourself. So that is what I learned, something new. Actually, I was able to put a name to it, which is the term novelty. A lot of times I was like, man, why am I always wanting to do this now? I'm like saying yes to all these things. And like, I can't stop. It's really just because I like newness. So once I learned that about myself, then I was able to start saying yes to the newness that is not going to cause me stress. So that's not signing up to be a part of a board or something, but maybe just like I just learned to swim like recently, and that has been relaxing and new. And so I also just put here, go back to what you loved when you were a kid. So if you liked reading as a kid, try to figure out how to read. If you liked playing basketball, try to figure out how to incorporate that as a way of self-care. And then finally, this is something I'm still learning, but I'm getting better at it. Is just be a friend, be a partner, be a child, be an aunt, be an uncle. Be yourself to the people that you love. Don't be a therapist. That's not your practice setting. Okay. So like your practice setting is when you're at work, but when you're with your friends and your family, you don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You don't have to have all the answers. Just be present for people that you love and care about, because your friends don't want a therapist. They just want you. Love the Redheads.
I'm so honored to be joined by the six of you all. This is like a full circle moment in the history of the AMFT podcast, in the sense that in family therapy, we have what is known as second order cybernetics, in the sense that you join the system and then become part of the system. So I made all these people listen to hours and hours of podcasts. Some of them, they listened to them in double time to get through them. But as you can tell, they're all fine representatives of our great profession, all systemic thinkers with their own unique voice, but a common core that binds us all together. So this is like second order podcast in the sense that you listen to it, now you're part of it. And this is certainly something that I've been very proud of, and I'm proud of all of you. And I thank you so much for your time and your words and your wisdom today. And what a great way to honor what we all love so much.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test-taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors. You want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy, from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Stay systemic, my friend.
It's up to the Eli.
Hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we illuminate. From theory to practice.